All right, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the findings in these Mesopotamian archives that have to do with customs from the time of the patriarchs. There's a number of discoveries or archives that contain valuable information for Old Testament studies, and I'll just quickly go through these just so you'll be familiar with what they are. The first one is Mari, a place on the Euphrates in northern Syria. This was an Amorite center. It was important from about 2500 down to 1750 or so B.C. Was excavated back in the 30s and then again in the 50s by a French group under André Perrault. Scoville has a section on Mari, so you can see what he has to say. They found some temples, a ziggurat there, temple tower. And the most important finding was a huge, huge palace of a king there. Named Zimri-Lin, it occupied about 15 acres altogether, just an enormous place. And in that palace, they found a collection of some 25,000 clay tablets dating from about 1800 to 1750 B.C. The people living there were Semitic types of people, and so they're somewhat related to the patriarchs, culturally speaking. And we find in these tablets references to customs and even names, very similar to what we find in the Old Testament. Then we have the findings at Nuzi. Nuzi was the capital of the Hurrians. And these folks are mentioned in the Old Testament, and they're called Horites or Hivites, and maybe even the Jebusites would be related to these people. And these folks carried on the Sumerian culture. The site of Nuzi is north of the Tigris River and southeast of Nineveh, sort of in upper Mesopotamia, but there 4,000 tablets were found, and these date between 1600 and 1400 B.C. And here we find a lot of laws and customs that reflect practices that were current in the times of the patriarchs. Then we have the site of Bogazkoi. B-O-G-A-Z-K-O-Y, if you can't read my writing. And this was the Hittite capital in Anatolia, in modern-day Turkey. It's being excavated by the Germans. They began in 1906, and they're still working there. So that's a long term project. Nuzi, incidentally, was excavated back in the 1920s. So here they have found a large collection, large archive of more than 10,000 clay tablets, and these are from 1750 down to 1200 BC, so into Middle Bronze and through the Late Bronze period. We have marriage arrangements dealt with in some of these tablets and covenant forms. Probably it's the covenants that are the most important finding here as far as Old Testament studies are concerned. And then we have a few tablets from a place in Syria, Alalakh, A-L-A-L-A-K-H. This is on the Orontes River, excavated by Sir Leonard Woolley in the 1930s and again in the 1940s. And there he found about 500 tablets. And these are from roughly 1800 to 1400 or so B.C. And again, they deal with customs, and in particular some marriage customs of those days. Bob, could I borrow your Bible? I forgot to bring mine in. It's always good to read the full text. So, from these tablets, we learn a lot about life in the days of the patriarchs. And some of the things that we read in the Old Testament seem a little strange, a little odd to us. We find were the common, ordinary customs of the day. Let's begin with Abraham and Eliezer of Damascus. In Genesis 15, we have a conversation between Abraham and God. As you recall, God had promised Abraham to make a great nation out of him. And the years went by, and Abraham suddenly found that he was quite an old man, and he still had not had a son of his own. And he's becoming concerned. So here in Genesis 15, verses 1 to 4, we see this concern. God says to Abraham in a vision, "Do not fear, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." Abraham answers, "O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" And then God goes on to reassure him that he would indeed have his own son. So what is with this Eliezer of Damascus? He says, "I am childless. The heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." Well, from these tablets, we now know that when a couple was childless, that they could adopt a son. And it seems that is what Abraham was doing here. There was a great emphasis on having children in those times. There was no social security system, of course. And so when you became old and you were unable to care for yourself, you were unable to go out into the field and to raise your own food and take care of your own flocks and animals, you would have to depend upon someone else, and that someone else would be your children. Well, if you didn't have children, you were in a bad spot. You had no one to care for you in your old age. You had no one to give you a decent burial. And so they had provisions for adopting children in the event that you were not able to have your own children. And there are many legal cases dealing with the rights of adopted children. And so there were laws that protected these adopted children. What if you adopted a son and then you had your own son? Would you just kick the adopted son out of your household? No, he had certain rights. He was legally adopted and he would have to receive a part of the inheritance. So there were legal cases concerning inheritance rights that are in these archives. And so we know something about the practice. And it seems that that's what Abraham did. He got a little concerned, and so he legally adopted this Eliezer from Damascus. And as things stood at that time when he was talking to God, this Eliezer would inherit all of Abraham's wealth, and indeed he was a wealthy man. Later on, we have the story of his servant going up to Padan Aram to find a wife for Isaac, probably the same man, although he's not named in that story. It's probably his number one steward and servant, Eliezer of Damascus. According to these Nuzi tablets, the adopted son had responsibilities. He would have to care for his adopted father in his old age and give him a decent burial. The adopted son, in turn, would inherit the adopted adopted father's possessions. And in the event a real son was born, then this real son would be the chief heir, but yet there would still be a portion that would have to go to the adopted son. Going on to chapter 16, we see that Sarah becomes concerned about this situation. Still no children born, and Sarah is now getting well along in years. So in chapter 16, Sarah, we're told, had borne Abraham no children, but she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her." And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah, and he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and then had a son. So again, this seems like a very strange custom to us, although having children by proxy is coming back into vogue, and there have been a number of cases of that recently, and so perhaps this custom will become prevalent once again, even in our culture. But in those days, again, this was another provision to have children. All right, the wife is barren. She can't have children. But perhaps the husband could have a child. And so this was one way to take care of that, is that the husband could have a child through another woman, and it would be a child by proxy. Notice what Sarah says in 16:2. "Perhaps I shall obtain children through her." She would consider this to be her child, because Abraham would be the father. And so it was a means of having children that you could call your own. And of course, Abraham was the father, so this child would have some inheritance rights and would have legal status. Again, the tablets speak about this sort of a thing happening quite often, in fact, in ancient times. Marriage contracts, many times, allowed for the having of children by proxy through another woman. The laws protected the rights of the handmaid, or whoever this mother was that was having the child on behalf of the true wife. And also, this handmaid was not to rank with her mistress. The mistress was still to be the head woman of the household. But we see in the biblical account here that Hagar begins to think she's better than Sarah, and her mistress was despised in her sight, we're told in verse 4 of chapter 16, and eventually she was cast out of the household, as you recall, because of her attitude. So, yes. He seemed to go along with it. He doesn't object, does he? We're just told that he went into Hagar, and she conceived. So this was Sarah's request, her idea, and Abraham went along with it.
The idea not come from the man.
I suppose. Sure. Yeah. I suppose it could come either way. Both of them are displaying a lack of faith here. That's the real problem. They didn't trust God and His promise to them. And they're taking the matter into their own hands. And what they're doing is simply following the customs of the day. We see in these tablets that the children born by such a union had certain inheritance rights. And again, there were legal cases that came into court because of a squabble in such situations between a real son and a child by proxy and so on. And so sometimes there had to be a court ruling in such situations. We have the same thing, of course, in the days of Jacob, where he had children through the handmaids of his wives. So this practice went on for many centuries, in fact, in the Middle Bronze and probably even into the Late Bronze period. In Genesis 23, we have the interesting story of Abraham's purchase of a plot of land. And this was after Sarah died. We're told that chapter 23, verse 1, Sarah lived to be 127. Verse 2, she died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. This is where Abraham spent most of his time, at the in the area of Hebron, at the area of Mamre. So Abraham needed a burial place for Sarah. Now, of course, Abraham came from further north, from Padan Aram. That's where his family was located. And they would have had a family tomb up there. And if he was living there, that's where he would have buried Sarah. But he's a newcomer to the land of Canaan. He owns no property. He has no family. He has no family tomb. And so he must acquire a family tomb. So we're told that he goes to the sons of Heth, the Hittites that were living there in Canaan. He says, "I'm a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight." And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, "Hearest, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead." And then they have this little negotiation. He says, "I'm interested in this plot of land that Ephron, the son of Zohar, owns." He says, "I want the cave of Machpelah," verse 9, "which he owns, which is at the end of his field." Okay, he says, "For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site." Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth. And this took place in the gate of the city, the gate of Hebron. And he answers them, he says, "No, my lord, I give you the whole field and the cave that is in it." And so Abraham gives in to this, and he pays him the price for the whole field and gets the field plus the cave. Now, at the beginning, Abraham only wanted the cave. Well, we find in amongst the text there, Bogazkoi, some, again, legal cases dealing with purchasing land and the responsibilities for taxes due on the land. And it turns out that if a buyer only buys a portion of a plot of land, that the original landowner is still responsible for the taxes on the whole plot. And so that seems to be why this Ephron wants to sell Abraham the whole plot rather than just the cave. Because if he just sold off the cave, then Ephron would still have to pay the taxes. But he wanted to get out from under that obligation, so he sells Abraham the whole thing, even though Abraham didn't want it. But it was no problem to Abraham. I guess he could easily cover the cost of those taxes. So he buys the whole thing. And so this is a legal transaction that's recorded here for us in Genesis 23. It's conducted in the gate of the city. It's conducted in front of witnesses. And in fact, those who have studied this text and compared it with some of these Hittite documents have concluded that there are even legal terms, Hittite legal terms, used here in Genesis 23. It seems that this cave is beneath the mosque that's located at Hebron, and it is indeed the authentic burial place for the patriarchs. There's some sepulchers down there beneath that mosque. Unfortunately, they won't allow anyone in there to really examine what's down there, but most scholars do believe that this is the cave of Machpelah purchased by Abraham, and it is the authentic burial place of the patriarchs. And perhaps there's even some remains there from the patriarchs, but we really don't know. Okay, let's go on to Genesis 31. Yeah. No, just some Hittites that came into Canaan.
Yeah.
We have the story of Jacob going up north to his uncle Laban and living up there for some number of years and marrying Laban's two daughters, Rachel and Leah. Eventually, Jacob decided it was time to leave. I guess God told him it was time to leave. And so in chapter 31, we have the account of Jacob getting together his family, his belongings, and parting company from his uncle Laban. And in verse 14, after he tells Rachel and Leah that they're going to be leaving, they say to Jacob, "Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you." So Rachel and Leah are concerned about their inheritance. Their father, of course, was a very wealthy man, and they would inherit some of that material wealth when he passed away. But now Jacob is saying, "Look, ladies, we've got to leave," and so they're concerned that they won't receive anything of their father's wealth. So then, going down a few verses to verse 19, "When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's." They leave, and Laban finds out that they've left. He's very concerned. He sets out after them. Finally catches up with them, has an exchange with Jacob, chiding him for leaving and not telling him. He says, "Gee, I couldn't say goodbye to my daughters, my grandchildren. I couldn't have a big party for you," so on and so forth. And when he gets through with all the polite exchanges here, he gets down to the crux of the matter in verse 30 of chapter 31. He says, "Why did you steal my gods?" Now, these gods that Rachel stole were nothing but little clay figurines. They weren't any big deal. But yet, they're very important to, first of all, to Rachel, and secondly, to her father, Laban. What's going on here? Well, Jacob, of course, knows nothing about this. He says, "Well, that's a terrible thing." He says, "Search everything we have. If you find these gods with anyone, then that person will be put to death." So Laban does just that. He goes to the trouble of searching through everything, and he comes to Rachel. Of course, she had hidden those idols under her saddle. She's sitting on the camel, and she says to her father, "Well, I'm having my period. I'm sorry, Dad, I can't get down." And so he says, "Okay," and he doesn't bother searching her too thoroughly or searching the saddle. And so he does not find the idols. So what's the significance here of these little clay figurines? Why couldn't Laban just go make himself some more or go buy some more? Why couldn't Rachel make her own or buy her own? Why did she want to have her father's clay idols? And why did Laban make such a big deal out of it when he caught up to Jacob and his daughters? Well, again, from these tablets, we know that these were more than simply idols or good luck charms or something of that sort, that the family idols, as they were called, the family teraphim is the Hebrew word. These household idols were considered to be title deeds to the family property, and that whoever held these family gods had, in effect, the title to the family property. And again, we have legal cases documented in these archives, where there will be a dispute over the family property, and the person who produces the family gods gets the rights to the property, wins the case. And so that seems to be the significance here of these teraphim, the family gods, that they were the gods that gave the title deeds to the property. I don't know how it worked. I suppose they would have to replace them somehow or another, and I don't know what the procedure was. But they were admissible as evidence in court. We have several cases that deal with these household gods. The other thing that we see in a lot of these ancient texts is the place of a sort of an oral last will and testament. Most people, of course, could not read or write, so a person's word carried tremendous weight. Many times, as the case with Abraham purchasing that plot of land, it was all done orally. It was an oral agreement, but there were witnesses there to be a witness to exactly the terms of this agreement, the price to be paid, and everything, so that if there was ever a question, they could go back to these witnesses and, you know, exactly what transpired there. So a person's word carried a lot of weight. It was binding, and in fact legally binding. And so we have examples of a last will and testament given orally. And again, we see in the patriarchal stories of the blessing that the father would give to his sons before he passed away. And again, it has that idea of that last will and testament, and it carried a great force, and it was something that was to be binding. So again, it's an accurate reflection of life in those times. All of these customs that we see reflected here in the Old Testament, again, help us to date these accounts, these stories, to the Middle Bronze period. They're not something that's a much later story made up in the exile period or some later time period, because they accurately reflect life in those days according to the chronology that we have given to us in the Old Testament. So they help to establish the accuracy and the eyewitness nature of our biblical accounts. Well, that's a quick run through and a quick overview of some of these customs and things that we encounter. Any questions? Yeah.
Just a comment. I think in Zion, sent that little 12-year-old girl down that hole in the...
At Hebron, yes, under the mosque.
Because he wanted to send soldiers down and they couldn't fit. But inside this 12-year-old girl, a daughter of one of the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And that lady is now a teacher in Jerusalem. She's about 30 years old.
Is that right? Uh-huh.
But I remember reading that in bar, and
yes.
I thought that was so exciting.
Yes, there's a write-up of what she saw. I can't remember. I think bones, and I'm not sure what all was down there.
Daughter.
Yeah.
And they had to send her down with a candle first to make sure she had enough oxygen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a place that you can visit. It's always closed whenever I've been there. Have you been there, Margaret, where they have the cenotaphs of the patriarchs?
The
yes.
Yes,
yeah. And they are identified as Abraham and Sarah and Jacob and so on. All the patriarchs are there. They even have Joseph, even though the Bible says Joseph was buried at Shechem. That doesn't matter. There's a tomb at Shechem as well. So that's one area. But then there's this chamber, cave, underneath, which they don't allow anybody to go into. And they, what, is that what it is? Yeah, there's some little opening. Yeah. So there is that one article in Bar, if you're interested, just tells about her adventure. When was that? That must have been quite a while ago.
30-something.
Yeah, yeah. So there's some treasures there, I'm sure, to be discovered if they would ever let anybody get down there and investigate to see what's there. Okay, well, if there's no questions, I guess we can start. See you then next week at 3 o'clock again.
Tell us something about the exact.
exam. Gee, that's months away, isn't it? You're going to start studying already. It'll be on the important things that we've covered. And, you know, notes, readings, wherever. A little bit of each. Yeah. But I felt it's necessary to know what's going on in Canaan as well, because it's important for when the Israelites come out of Egypt as to what they encounter in the land of Canaan. So as far as the sojourn period is concerned, in the scriptures we have basically the Joseph story. That's pretty well it. We have a very full, detailed accounting of Joseph's time in Egypt, at least the period of time where he was the great high officer official in the Egyptian administration. Then we have fewer details after that period of time. But at least we have all the information surrounding the circumstances which brought the Israelites into Egypt. And then, from that point to the end of the sojourn, very little information. And then, of course, the details begin again with Moses and so on. Let me pass out a handout here. There's two sides to this. The first side gives you something about the history of the period when Joseph was there in Egypt. And then on the back are some information about Egyptian background to the Joseph story. So that's what I'd like to focus on. Is basically that Joseph story. It's a delightful account, very well written, of course, excellent literature. One of the good things about archaeological discoveries is that we're able to put the Bible in its context. We have quite a bit of literature from Egypt that's been recovered. And so we can compare, for example, this Joseph story with contemporary Egyptian literature, and we find that there's really no comparison, that Joseph's story is just far and away superior to anything that has come out of Egypt or out of the ancient world as far as that's concerned. The story is just masterfully told. This isn't a class in literary analysis, but I can't help but comment on what a wonderful piece of literature it is. It has all the elements of a good story. It has suspense and love and irony and hatred, all of those good elements that we like to see in a story. It builds up to a very, very exciting climax. A lot of tension builds up. And then Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. That breaks all the tension that's been building and building throughout the story. In fact, it all breaks in one moment. And then we have the outworking of the rest of the story. The whole thing actually is set in what's called a chiastic structure, of building up to this climax. And then we have parallel elements, balancing elements from the beginning and from the backside of the story. So it's just masterfully done. It's basically a love story, not romantic love that we hear so much of today, but the story of the love of a father and his son. And that runs all the way through. And that is very powerful and very strong throughout this story. I've taught Hebrew in the past, and I've always enjoyed using the Joseph story to teach Hebrew, because it's just so rich. So there's a lot of spiritual lessons in it, of course. But we also see a lot of Egyptian background to the story, authentic Egyptian background, which shows us that there's little question but what the story is set in Egypt. There's just so many elements in this story that it had to have been written there on the spot. Joseph, of course, rose to this high position in Egypt, and he had many people under him. And, of course, amongst those workers and various servants and so on. He would have had scribes. So if Joseph himself could not read and write, probably he couldn't because of his own background. He would have had people in his employment that could have put all this information into writing immediately as soon as he wanted to dictate it. So I don't see any problem with this being seen as a more or less eyewitness account of the events that are told there. So let's first of all look at a little bit of the history of the times. We're in the Egyptian Middle Kingdom. That's the time frame. Now we can work out the chronology for Joseph once we have set the date of the Exodus at 1450, as we've discussed. Then it's a matter of just working back from that point. We're told that the Israelites were in Egypt for 430 years. That's the total length of the sojourn. So that would mean that Jacob and his family came into the country in 1880 B.C. And once you have that, you can then work everything else out, because we know at that point in time, Joseph was 39 years old. So we just work back and we can come up with Joseph's date of birth in 1919 and all the other dates we can work out from that. So we know the chronology quite well. The only thing we can't nail down specifically is when Joseph was in prison. We know approximately within limits, so I've indicated approximately for that. But we don't know the length of time he was there or the exact years he was there. But it had to have fallen, of course, between his 17th year and his 30th year. We could even narrow it down more than that, because he served Potiphar for a number of years before he was put into prison. So with that, then, we can compare it to the Egyptian history that you have there on the left side. Again, this isn't terribly precise. Depending on which book you look at, you might get different dates. This is a very recent chronology. I've got out in the upper right-hand corner there the source of the Egyptian chronology. It's from a recent article by Kenneth Kitchen, 1989. The original article was when 87, then he corrected it in 89. These are the 89 corrections. So, at any rate, this all took place in the Egyptian Middle Kingdom, the 12th dynasty. And at this time in Egyptian history, Egypt was at the height of her prosperity and at the height of her art and literature. In fact, in later years, they look back on this period as sort of a golden age, and they try to duplicate life and culture and art and everything that was there in the Middle Kingdom period. We can make a number of connections between the life of Joseph and Egyptian history that works out quite nicely. Now, in many books, you'll read that Joseph was in Egypt and rose to power during the Hyksos period. Now, we talked about this last time when the Hyksos rose to power, and I think the dates I have on the sheet are 1660 to 1540. You can check that chronology sheet. But at any rate, you could only have that kind of an alignment if you went with the late date. In fact, I think that's one of the arguments for the late date of the Exodus and conquest, is it puts Joseph in Egypt in the time of Hyksos, which would provide, according to those who promote this view, provide the proper setting for him to rise to power, since the Hyksos were Semitic peoples. The idea is that Joseph, being a Semite, could have risen to power under the rule of these Hyksos Semitic rulers. Well, we have many examples of Semitic people rising to high positions under the native Egyptians. So I don't think we necessarily need the Hyksos in place in order for Joseph to have achieved the position he achieved. And in fact, it might have even been more difficult. These Hyksos, we now know, were Canaanites and urbanites. And there was always a certain amount of animosity between the urbanites and the pastoralists, which of course Joseph was. He was an apiru, or pastoralist, someone not from an urban center. So I don't really think that argument carries a lot of weight, that Joseph would have to be there during the time of the Hyksos period. According to our biblical chronology, in fact, he's there well before that, and he rose to power during the Middle Kingdom, and we have a number of very nice connections between events in the Joseph account and events from Egyptian history, and we'll point some of those out as we're going along here. On the back, you have some of the Egyptian background titles, names, words, some of the cultural aspects that we see in the story. Immediately, when Joseph comes in to Egypt, of course, he's brought in by this caravan. His brothers had sold him to these merchants. They bring him into Egypt at age 17, and he's sold to a man named Potiphar, a captain of the guard. And right away, we see an authentic Egyptian name, and we see an authentic Egyptian title. This is typical of the Joseph story. We have these bona fide Egyptian names throughout the story and correct Egyptian titles. Captain of the guard was the head of the, sort of like the palace guard for the pharaoh. We find further along in the story he had responsibility for the prison of the servants or the employees of the pharaoh. Of course, he had a very large staff, so they had a prison just for those people when they got out of line. It was called the royal prison. He was responsible for the guards. He was responsible for those who would go before the pharaoh when he went out in his chariot and tell the people to bow down, that pharaoh was coming. So it was a very important position that this man had. And he, of course, like all Egyptian officials, had his own estate. And he employed Joseph as at first just as a slave, but as he saw Joseph's abilities and the fact that God was with him in everything that he did, he soon promoted him to the administrator of the estate. Now, this, again, is an Egyptian title, and in the Egyptian, it would be mer-per. Per is the house, and mer is the overseer, or the administrator. So, Joseph was the overseer of the house, and the chief steward, basically, and as such, he would have responsibility for all of the affairs of the estate. And in fact, when he has the problem with Potiphar's wife, he tells her that Potiphar has given him authority in all aspects of running the estate. The only thing, of course, that he was not to have access to was to Potiphar's wife. But everything else, he had control of. All of his finances and all of his affairs were under Joseph's control. All the way through the story, of course, we can see the hand of God as he's preparing Joseph for that ultimate position. So in this job here as the chief administrator or steward, he learns all about the Egyptian bureaucracy and methods and farming methods and everything that he needs to know for his much larger responsibility later on. Then, of course, he has this run-in with Potiphar's wife, ends up in prison. Officers or servants of Pharaoh, the chief of the cupbearers and the chief of the bakers. Again, both authentic Egyptian titles. We know them from Egyptian inscriptions and even some tomb paintings that depict these offices. And he, Joseph correctly interpreted their dreams. This was brought to the attention of Pharaoh when he had these very disturbing dreams about the cows and the grain and all of that. And eventually he's called in before Pharaoh, and he interprets Pharaoh's dreams as, of course, predicting the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. And Joseph tells Pharaoh that he should appoint someone that could stockpile the food during those years of plenty. And Pharaoh says, well, there's no one as wise as you are, so we'll make you that man. Now, the ceremony that follows is very interesting, and here we have a lot of Egyptian background. In Genesis 41, starting with verse 39, Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. So now Joseph is the chief administrator of all of Egypt. Before he was just over a particular estate. Now he's over all of Egypt. And in verse 40, Pharaoh tells him, you shall be in charge of my palace, and my people are to submit to your orders. Actually, the word in the Hebrew is, you shall be over my house. And so now, Joseph is the overseer of the royal house. And that's the actual title. And he is the administrator of the royal estates. Now, of course, theoretically, Pharaoh owned all the land of Egypt. And so that's why he can tell Joseph that he's going to be over all the land of Egypt. Now, technically speaking, well, what we know from the Middle Kingdom period is that early in the Middle Kingdom, there was a kind of a feudalistic type of organization. And I've indicated that on the handout there, Joseph in Egyptian History. We see it's a feudalistic state under the first two or three pharaohs. In fact, up to the time of the fourth pharaoh, it seems to continue. And so even though technically, theoretically, Pharaoh had control or ownership of all the land of Egypt, in reality, there were these what were called nomarchs, men in charge of large areas of Egypt. Egypt was divided up into these various nomes and districts, and there would be a person in charge of each of these nomes called a nomarch. And early on in the Middle Kingdom, these nomarchs had tremendous power. And so the power was kind of decentralized early on. So now Joseph is made the mer-per-wer, the administrator of the royal estates. You might read in some commentaries and books that Joseph was made the grand vizier. This is a title that we know from ancient Egypt. But the office of the grand vizier was quite a bit different than the office that Joseph was appointed to. The grand vizier was more of a political office. Didn't do the kinds of things Joseph did. So this is, I think, really something new, newly created by Pharaoh for this unique situation, the administrator of the royal estates. Once the famine was over, it's quite apparent that Joseph was somewhat demoted. At least he didn't have the power and the authority that he once had. Because when we get a little further in the story, when Jacob dies and Joseph wants to take his father's body back to Canaan to bury Jacob,
Joseph at that point does not have direct access to Pharaoh. He has to go through Pharaoh's servants and through the chain of command. And even though he's still an important official of some sort, and he can, of course, request things of the Pharaoh, he doesn't have that closeness to the Pharaoh that he had earlier on when he was the administrator of the royal estates. So it seems that this is a special office created by Pharaoh for this particular situation in Egypt. So after he appoints him to this office, then we have in Genesis 41 an installation ceremony. And here again, this is a very rich in Egyptian background. So Pharaoh said to Joseph in verse 41, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. What he's doing here, of course, is giving Joseph the royal seal. The seal, the cartouche of the Pharaoh. He has some very nice artifacts on him. One of them is a scarab here, and that was quite often used in a ring as a signet. But I think from Pharaoh's hand, it would have been a solid gold ring. We have some examples of such rings from the tomb of King Tutankhamun. Several of them, four or five or maybe six solid gold rings with the cartouche of Tutankhamun on the ring. And I would imagine that's the kind of ring that the Pharaoh gave to Joseph here. Now, this is in the year 1889, and if our chronology is correct, this would have been under Amenemhat II. But these dates are somewhat fluid, so that is not certain. So he gives him then this royal signet, which would give him the authority for sealing documents, proclamations, correspondence, whatever. He would have the official seal of Pharaoh, the highest seal, of course, of the land. So now he had the emblems of the royal office, and he had all the power that he would need to carry out his work. Secondly, he dressed him in robes of fine linen. Of course, Joseph had just come out of prison. They cleaned him up, they shaved him for this audience with Pharaoh, but he had no fine garments fitting to the office of the administrator of the royal estate. So Pharaoh provided him in robes of fine linen. One of the neat things to do with the Joseph story is to trace the use or the function of Joseph's garments all the way through the story. This is just one example. Every time there's a change of his garments, there's a change of Joseph's status. This begins with the coat of many colors his father made him, indicative of his favorite status with his father. The brothers rip that off, and he's thrown into the pit, and that's the end of that status or phase of his life, and then he's made the steward. And, of course, he would have the garments of a steward, and then he's thrown into prison. He has prison garments, but now his prison garments are taken off or whatever he had on. He's dressed in the robes of fine linen, so now he has a new status, a new position. Going back one step, when he was the administrator of the estate under Potiphar, when he went in, he had that run-in with Potiphar's wife. Remember what she did? She tore his cloak off. And that, again, that was a change of his situation, his status. And all the way through we see this. The author uses so many things like this in the story. It's just masterfully done. At any rate, now he has the garments appropriate to his new status and position there in Egypt. And then Pharaoh puts a gold chain around his neck. Now this is very significant. And we have many instances of this kind of thing in the Egyptian tomb paintings. And this is always associated with a ceremony called the bestowing of the gold of favor. And this ceremony was for someone who had done a very good job for Pharaoh in whatever office they had. And Pharaoh was rewarding them for their meritorious service. And they would come before the Pharaoh, and he would put this gold chain around the neck of the person, and then give them many, many other gifts as well. What we see here is a combination of two ceremonies lumped into one. There's the investiture ceremony, where Joseph is made this new office, or given this new position. So he's invested as the head of the royal estates. But also, we have this bestowing of the gold of favor. Now, normally, that's only done after a person has served for a time, and he's earned the right for this special honor. But in Joseph's situation, he had absolutely nothing. He came out of prison. And in order for him to function in this new role, he had to have some material possessions and some amount of wealth and so on. I mean, after all, he was going to be entertaining great important people, and he had to pay his servants. He would have been given an estate and so on. So Pharaoh combines the two ceremonies, and he not only installs him in the office, but he gives them what he needs, the material possessions he needs, appropriate to his new status. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command. So, of course, he would be given a chariot. He would need a chariot to carry out his work, and this is going to be the second chariot next to Pharaoh. And it says the men shouted before him, "Make way." Now, this is somewhat ironic, because those men that were running before his chariot, shouting, "Make way," bow the knee is literally what it says, bow the knee, are the men who worked for Potiphar, who Joseph worked for there on the estate. So now, in a way, Potiphar is working for Joseph and providing guards and these people to run before his chariot and so on. Thus, Pharaoh put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then in verse 45, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah. Again, it's a good Egyptian name. No question about it. It's always a Hebrew name. But we cannot work out the meaning of it. Now, different authors have offered different ideas, but the Egyptologists who really know their stuff say, we really